I was scheduled on October 13th, a Saturday, to teach a day-long class for the Sati Center on the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, with the idea that the way that mindfulness is taught by us Western Dharma teachers is a little bit different from the way that it's taught by the Buddha. And it might be interesting to go back and actually see how he taught it, what he was taught, teaching and pointing to when he talked about mindfulness. But beginning to prepare for that class, I didn't find myself very inspired to do it anymore, given September 11th. And last weekend I did a workshop, or a weekend kind of workshop, in Los Angeles that was focused on the Buddha's teachings on peace. And I collected together a whole bunch of the selections, quotes from the Buddha, from the discourses of the Buddha, on the topic of peace and violence and nonviolence. And it was a very nice thing to do, given our times. And so what I decided to do is, that time, October 13th, not teach the class I was slated to teach, but rather do a day on the Buddha's teachings on peace. And there are flyers there on the table, if anyone is interested in doing that. Cheryl says everything's okay. She came and got the doctor. yesterday at the Portola Valley, the one-day sitting in St. Mark's, in the middle of the Dharma talk, some child, there were all these children in the park nearby playing soccer, and we heard this child kind of banging against the window of the door, the glass door, and kind of whimpering or crying. And at first, it didn't seem like much. It seemed like kids, maybe, I don't know, just kids somehow. And then it got a little bit more dramatic, and vaguely it seemed like maybe there was a scuffle outside, or something, two people involved. And then there was a glass, kind of glass window you couldn't quite see through, but you could see suddenly these two hands kind of banging against the window, trying to get in. And it began to seem kind of more dire. And so we went outside to see what was going on. And there was a maybe 13-year-old boy who was autistic, who was mother was struggling to try to keep, I don't know what the right word is, but under control. And so we opened this door, and the kid, you know, I didn't realize the kid was autistic. I tried to engage the kid in a nice, friendly way, and you know, he just brushed me off and walked right into the room like we were sitting here. He just walked right in the middle and proceeded to walk through the hall into the bathrooms, and he really likes water. So he went to the toilet and locked himself in the toilet, and he likes flushing the toilet. So he did that for a while, and we heard the toilet flushing, and it felt, you know, kind of painful to see the circumstance, see the mother trying to work with it, and the only thing I could think of offering was our kind of acceptance of the circumstance, that we assure the mother that the boy could just wander freely around us and through us and in our building and not have to be concerned about disturbing us and our Dharma activity. And so after a while he finished, and then he walked through again. And it'd be nice to hope that somehow walking through a group of 30, 40 people sitting meditating had a beneficial impact on someone to walk through, mother or the son. So we never know when things show up. And someone pointed out that September 11th in New York City was a beautiful day. Unexpected what happened. So one of the things that's been on my mind is the question of how do we relate to other people in times of tragedy, in times of violence. How do we relate to others? And there's a very simple teaching by the Buddha on this topic, where he said, he encouraged us to compare ourselves to others or liken ourselves to others, find parallel in others through ourselves. He said something like, all beings, all people fear violence. All all beings cherish their lives, likening oneself to others, likening others to oneself, don't cause harm towards anyone. And you find over and over again in the Buddhist tradition this emphasis of, in English we'd say, putting ourselves in the other people's shoes. Imagine ourselves as others, and how would you want to treat them then? It's kind of a universal ethical kind of approach to life, is to consider the other as oneself. Some years ago, there was a psychologist, a researcher, named something like Susan Langer. Langer was her last name, is her last name. She wrote a book called Mindfulness, where she tried to study, she claimed to study mindfulness as a Western topic. She claimed no real connection with Eastern Buddhist teachings of mindfulness, and we're just exploring it as a function of psychological functioning that could be studied by Western psychologists. And so she was doing research on this topic. And in her book, she describes doing an experiment with some grade school kids, where she has two groups of kids, and she takes them, gives them both a series of examinations. And the first group, she tells, there's only one right answer to these questions. And the second group, she tells, there's a number of right answers to these questions. Find a few of those right answers. So they do this test for a while, and then the experiment comes where they then show these kids photographs of different people, some who are with handicaps in wheelchairs or blind, some who have no particular handicaps. And so they have this collage of different photographs of people, and then they're told that they have to select kind of teammates, people to play with, for different activities. So, I guess, some kind of sports. There's a sing-along. Who would you like to be with you in your sing-along? Who would you like to be along with you to play pin the tail on the donkey, where, you blindfold people? And the people who had been told that there was only one right answer to the test, they tended to only pick the healthy people, or so-called people who had no disabilities. They typed people into very black and white categories and just chose the people who were so-called normal, perhaps. And the kids who had been taking the examinations where there were a number of right answers, they supposed to find a number of right answers, they tended to look not at the... they didn't tend to judge the person. They tended to judge the functioning of the person. So they made function-specific decisions rather than person-specific decisions about who they were going to pick for their activity. So if you can do a sing-along, it doesn't really matter if someone's in a wheelchair or not, because that has no bearing on it. And if you're going to do, pin the tail on a donkey, it doesn't matter if a person's blind, because that's the whole point of the game, is to be blind. And so the point being that the kids were somehow conditioned or trained to think more broadly, to think more function-specifically in the choices they had to make, rather than person-specific. And there's a strong tendency, I think, for many of us to have been trained to look for this one right answer for how things should be, and to be very uncomfortable with ambiguity or complexity. And if we want to have be right, we want to be to know what's going on. Because a lot of security comes with thinking we know what's going on, or if we know what the right response is. And so often people will latch on to the first idea that comes along, and this is the only right answer. This is the answer. This is the way. And there can be a whole training in beginning to broaden our mind to see maybe there's a number of variety of solutions. There's a complexity in an individual and in the world around us. I was also impressed by her book. She had an experiment where she showed, movies, kind of television. Videos of different people. And so the subjects of the experiment were watching these, there were three groups, they were watching these people on video. And for the first group, they were told what kind of people where they were watching. And they were given all kinds of categories. Nothing really to do with who they really were. But they were told, this is a deviant. You know, this is a, you know, terrorist. And, you know, they kind of listed all these kind of types of people. And some kind of negatively, some positively. The second group, they just said, watch this videos carefully. That's all they said. And the third group, they said, just you watch this. It's like, you know, it's like you're watching television at home. Just we want you to kind of be, you know, kind of cat. You're kind of just watch this, you know. And what they found was that the people who were told to watch carefully, and the people who were told who they were watching, especially because they were told, mostly maybe all the people were told, were somehow had deviant type of labels. They were able to, after watching these videos, they were able to report much greater detail about what they saw on the video, the kind of characteristics of the person, their hair color, and how they talked or how they were. And they were able to remember many more details of what they were watching. They were more hyper. They were more alert to what was going on. Whereas the people who were just kind of told to watch television like you watch television at home, they did not remember very much at all. And it struck me quite a bit that mindfulness by itself can be used, can be heightened out of a sense of threat or a sense of criticism or judgment of someone. And it could also be used kind of very neutrally, just pay more careful attention. And in a sense, what they found was the people who were given negative labels for the people, their mindfulness was more heightened. But they used that mindfulness in the service of being more critical and being more, or having more prejudice for what they were watching and seeing. Even though they could watch, they could actually see more detail, they used it in the service of their prejudice. So mindfulness itself is relatively neutral, perhaps. Maybe it's just like, you know, a clear glass. You know, you train your mindfulness, you clean the glass in your window so you can see clearly. But a glass window is ethically neutral. It's just clear window. Perhaps mindfulness by itself is ethically neutral. And we need to bring something else into play if we want to live an ethical life, want to live a life that wisely and compassionately relates to the world around us. And one of the things the Buddha then taught was this exercise of empathy, of likening yourself to others. One of the areas of, if I can kind of take a little different track for a moment, of complexity is when we look at ourselves. And some people would like to latch on to a particular view of who they are. I am this way. This is the way I should be. And I need to be right. Or some people take, I'm wrong, and this is the way it is. And there's a lot of people who aren't very comfortable with allowing for complexity in their own minds and their hearts, and not willing to see themselves as actually having a range of wholesome and unwholesome qualities within them. I know people who are horrified that they would have some bad thought, that they would think badly about anything. And so I know people who have actually repressed that part of themselves and kind of create a veneer of being kind of goody-goody in a sense, because they're so frightened of the voices within them that might be a little bit violent or aggressive or hateful or whatever. One of the things that I've heard a lot since September 11th is that if we retaliate against whoever we think has caused these terrorist attacks with hate, then we're becoming what we hate. And though most people who act out of hate don't usually take the mirror back on themselves and see the same behavior in themselves, they often see the world black and white. I'm the good guys and that's the bad guys. It's been pointed out by some people, Carl Jung for one, for whatever he's worth, that sometimes when we make very black and white separations in the world between good and bad, them and us, it represents a division in our own minds. And it becomes kind of a violence to ourselves also. If we insist on seeing the world in black and white terms, good guys and bad guys, good gals and bad gals, then chances are that we're also unwilling then to see ourselves in our complexity. But we divide ourselves along the same category, and often then we'll see ourselves as, you know, the good guys. But sometimes it's the opposite. Part of, I think, what mindfulness calls upon us to do is to relax the categories by which we hold things in a certain way and allow for the complexity to show itself, to allow a whole range of what's going on in us to show itself. And then to do that with compassion, with acceptance. Acceptance is that this is a normal part of human life. I was felt very fortunate that when I was 14 or so, my father pulled me aside, as you know, this father-son kind of talk, and he told me, as you grow up, you'll find times when you have really bizarre thoughts. And this is really normal. You don't have to think you're crazy. And I didn't think about it much at the time, but sure enough, there were times I had really bizarre thoughts. And I had been warned that this was normal. Isn't that great? As opposed to, you know, thinking, wow, I hope no one notices, and this is really bad, and how could I think this way? So to somehow be accepting, maybe not allowing in the sense of acting on these things, but very accepting of the complexity within ourselves, and willing to see the range of thoughts and responses and motivations and ideas that exist within ourselves. And what happens then is that it becomes harder to see the other people, as radically different than ourselves. One of the, you know, to see that you have a capacity to hate in some corner of your mind, then you're more likely to empathize somewhat with someone else who expresses hate overtly. If you suffer, it's a lot easier to see other people suffering in an empathetic way. The near enemy of compassion in Buddhism is pity. And pity is when you remove yourself from pity occurs when you don't see that yourself as an equal with someone else in their suffering, but rather see yourself a little bit above them, kind of looking down and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry for you. You know, I'll help you." You know. And what does it take to see someone in their suffering as equals? Is what Buddhist practice is supposed to lead us to. So part of it is to begin discerning the complexity in ourselves and see the wide range. Maybe today you happen to be a saint, and it's very nice. We're all happy for that. But maybe tomorrow you won't be. Who knows what's going to happen to you tomorrow? I'm kind of in awe in my own mind, my own reactions, by the wide range that I'm capable of having when the conditions around me change. And, you know, there are times when I was in the monastery that, I was pretty saintly. Thank you. And times when, you know, a family crisis, that, that's not what I would call myself. So to be accepting of the complexity within ourselves. So how do we relate to others, and how do we relate to ourselves, and how do we relate self, how do we compare, how do we empathize? Empathizing has to do with the wisdom of knowing how to see ourselves wisely, clearly, and how to see someone else. One of the great poems coming out of the Buddhist world in the last generation or so is the poem by Thich Nhat Hanh called "Please Call Me by My True Names." And maybe many of you have heard it many times. And if you have, you can think of it as our liturgy. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, "Please call me by my true names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird whose wings are still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope, The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river. And I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. And I am also the grass snake, who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee in a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo, with plenty of power in my hands, and I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. So here Thich Nhat Hanh sees himself in the other. And he certainly sees the world in a polarity between the victim and the perpetrator of the various forms of violence. He sees a distinction between them. He's not ignoring that distinction. But he's also not going to see that person as being separate than himself. He's not going to lock that person out of his heart. And as he requests at the very end is, please call me by my true names so I can wake up and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. Can it be our wish, our desire, our motivation that the doors of compassion remain open? And can the sense of compassion, the desire for compassion, the wish for it, be stronger than any other wish that we have? Can we have enough, put enough value in compassion that even when the complexity of who we are brings forth all kind of range of responses, that the motivation to find compassion, to keep our hearts open, is on the forefront of what we want to do? So then after September 11th, and there was a couple by the name of Frederick and Mary Ann Broussat who took Thich Nhat Hanh's poem and adapted it. I am a World Trade Center tower, standing tall in the clear blue sky, feeling a violent blow to my side. And I am a towering inferno of pain and suffering, imploding upon myself and collapsing to the ground. I am a terrified passenger on a hijacked airplane, not knowing where we are going, or that I am riding on fuel tanks that will be instruments of death. And I am a worker arriving at my office, not knowing that in just a moment my future will be obliterated. I am a pigeon in the plaza between the two towers, eating crumbs from someone's breakfast, when fire rains down on me from the skies. And I am a bed of flowers admired daily by hundreds and thousands of tourists now buried under five stories of rubble. I am a firefighter sent into dark corridors of smoke and debris on a mission of mercy only to have it collapse around me. And I am a rescue worker risking my life to save lives who is very aware that I may not make it out alive. I am a survivor who has fled down the stairs and out of the building to safety, who knows that nothing will ever be the same in my soul again. And I am a doctor in a hospital treating patients burned from head to toe, who knows that these horrible images will remain in my mind forever. I am a resident in an apartment in downtown New York who has been forced to evacuate my home. And I am a resident in an apartment uptown who has walked 100 blocks home in a stream of other refugees. I am a family member who has just learned that someone I love has died. And I am a pastor who must comfort someone who has suffered a heartbreaking loss. I am a loyal American who feels violated and vows to stand behind any military action it takes to wipe terrorists off the face of the earth. And I am a loyal American who feels violated and worries that people who look and sound like me are all going to be blamed for this tragedy. I am a boy in New Jersey waiting for a father who will never come home. And I'm a boy in a faraway country rejoicing in the streets of my village because someone has hurt the hated Americans. I am a terrorist whose hatred for America knows no limit, and I am willing to die to prove it. And I am a terrorist sympathizer standing with all the enemies of American capitalism and imperialism. And I am a master strategist for a terrorist group who planned this abomination. My heart is not yet capable of openness, tolerance, and loving. I am a citizen of the world, glued to my television set, fighting back my rage and despair at these terrible events. And I am a person of faith, struggling to forgive the unforgivable, searching for compassion for all. So the search for compassion, the motivation to find it, and to keep it in the forefront, and to allow ourselves to see the complexity of it all, rather than see something in black and white terms. I was also, in thinking about this, reminded of this poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. Is that how you pronounce her own name? She's an American Egyptian. And it's called kindness. And maybe it could just as well be called compassion. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow, and you must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that rises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. How many times have we experienced some great loss or suffering or made some big mistake in our lives, and it kind of makes us quite tender as a result? How many times has it made us more bitter, more hardened? The choice is ours to make, which one we take. And I hope that we can always choose the kindness, the compassion, and to let the tragedies of the world, our suffering, and the sorrows, that we allow ourselves to feel the depth of it so that we can feel the depth of compassion and kindness. So we leave those situations And kindness ties our shoes. Kindness buys the bread. That kindness, compassion, love, is something we carry with us. It's always close at hand, as she says, that goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. Last thing I'll read is my favorite quotes from Thomas Merton. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths where neither sin nor desire can reach, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could see themselves as they really are, if only we could see each other that way, there would be no reason for war, for hatred, for cruelty. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. So those are my thoughts for today. I'm still very much filled with the recent events. And I hope that the sense of tenderness and kindness or compassion or vulnerability that I felt since September 11th remains with me. So any thoughts or questions anyone would like to ask this morning? Or comments? Yes? I think it's I mean, for me, that I don't want to second guess myself, or I don't want to have some fixed idea of how I'm going to respond in different situations where I find myself. My commitment is to try to meet the situation with compassion and with harmlessness, but I don't want to carry that with me as a kind of fixed policy either. But it's the commitment to try to find that way, to work towards that. But the ability to put ourselves in other people's shoes is often quite helpful. And it can often soften a lot of conflict. Maybe not when some terrorist has a gun to your face, but sometimes in other situations. I've seen so many times where I've been involved or been somehow connected to conflict, where the conflict was disarmed by listening to the other person. And I've seen times where conflict has been exasperated when people weren't willing to listen to each other. Somehow the other party was discounted. Oh, those people are crazy. You know, they don't know what they're talking about. Let's not give them any creed, and just adds to the conflict, adds to the tension. But if people really get listened to, there's so many times that things change quite a bit. And I don't know about the actual terrorists and, you know, that are these little cells that are operating, how to get to them. There's all these supporters of them. There's a whole, you know, whole communities of people who are supporting them, and there are children going up in communities that there's tremendous suffering and poverty. And can we listen to those people? Can we listen to the terrorists of 20 years who are going to be, you know, the potential terrorists for 20 years, and listen to their suffering and their need, and try to respond to that? If we just kind of, you know, make it very black and white, then you know, it's not going to be that helpful in the long term. But also to put ourselves in other people's shoes means to realize that there are different perspectives for looking at the same event. The from the point of view of our perspective, it's completely unforgivable. It's awful what happened in New York City and Washington D.C. And I would never argue that it wasn't. But then to want to have to retaliate, which is just a cry, you know, rallying cry in America, somehow retaliation. Retaliation doesn't necessarily, it looks like it's justice from our point of view, but from the children of the people who get killed because of our retaliation, it feels like vengeance to them. And then their response is, my father was killed out of vengeance by America. I need to retaliate. And, you know, it goes on and on. We see many places in the world where vengeance and retaliation just goes back and forth. And part of the reason it keeps perpetuating through time is that from the perspective of both parties, they both see themselves as being right. They both have been wronged, and they're righting a wrong. And unless we can somehow see that there are different perspectives and that in some way, not to justify it, in some way, see the situation through the eyes of the other, that we're not going to learn how to respond in a way that's probably helpful. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the flag situation in terms of the world flag, U.S. flag thing, and it's the idea about battle of rights and wrongs and opinions, and how dangerous it is to have opinions this time? You said that
other... Can you speak a little bit slower for my...
The flag... symbolic situation is something that's troubling me, and that I feel that if I don't have a world flag, I'm annoyed at all the flags that are people flying. I think because I come from a place where flags were flown, you love the war. You didn't fly a flag to be a sign of unity, and some people are flying flags these days of compassion, unity, and sorrow for all the 6,000 families and deaths. So I'm debating. I think sometimes if I don't fly the world flag, am I being complicit in being quiet and not being a good Buddhist? And then if I fly a world flag and an American flag, am I picking symbols, having a symbol bubble on my vehicle? So I'm really trying to sort out, you know, I don't want to not have a flag, but I think by just being quiet, I'm allowing a certain kind of militaristic point of view to prevail. So I think what happens is that these signs of flag unity are transposed by militaristic world leaders into battle cries. So I'm really trying to figure out what to do. And I'm afraid I'll have to have a world flag in my car, but beaten up by somebody. Like you said, you know, if someone sees me with a world flag, he must be some pink belt commie that's a ghetto. And so I'm just kind of trying to sort out that issue of not being fearful of having a world flag. I feel like I'm guilty of chicken. Would, you know, be out there with my true so-called pacifist beliefs and work, and then have to fight my whole flag. You know, yeah. I'm out there get the roadside fight with somebody with the American flag and the world flag. Follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, patriotism is a very complex phenomena, and so many things are held underneath that. There's something justified by it, and it's been said something like, you know, that. You know, the strongest bastion for patriotism is fascism or something like that. You know,
yeah.
That you can justify a lot under the word patriotism. If that's not patriotic, and so then you justify.
I think comparing myself to German citizens during World War II, who allowed the Nazis to kind of run a death machine.
It's very hard. You know, it's very hard because you know all this is very difficult for all of us. There's a complexity, and I find myself talking to a lot of people who kind of want peace and don't want war, And but it's, you know, it's very, as has been said, you know, this is a very different than fighting, you know, being anti-Vietnam War. You know, it's a whole different event, and you know, we certainly don't want to be in a situation of not defending ourselves or not bringing perpetrators to some kind of justice, and which requires the use of some gun. I mean, I can't imagine going in there with an arrest warrant to Afghanistan and say, "Please come with me." So, you know, where's the line between, you know, a useful police action or a useful defense action that requires what it does, and you know, retaliation in war, and you know, I it's not so clear to me actually where that line should be. Some of it, I think, resides in the rhetoric we use, and we have to be a little bit careful with the rhetoric because it can inflame things. Yeah, Helen.
I've been very frustrated with it. Suppose I do speak out and say, I don't want war. In the current situation, that's not going to be heard. And then I came up with an idea yesterday that made me feel a lot better. An idea was, maybe what we should be speaking out for every dollar we spend for war, we should spend the dollar for compassion. We should spend the dollar for humanitarian aid. For every dollar we spend for extra policing, we should spend the dollar for making conditions better for people.
Beautiful.
And maybe that's a campaign that more of the population could be behind. I think a lot of people are feeling patriotic, but at the same time also feeling a lot of additional compassion.
I've seen similar. I don't think, for me, it's not good enough to be against war. And, I mean, that's kind of, I take that kind of for granted. But to go around protesting war seems to me personally kind of flat. And I think what I hope to see is a movement where we're a movement that is offering an alternative.
That's what you're
suggesting. So we offer an alternative. We say, you know, we're going to march for, you know, for the Afghani refugee camps, or, you know, increasing, you know, trying to develop Pakistan in some way, or, you know, I have no idea what the right action should be, but rather than being against something before something, but being for something, it's very clear that's an alternative to war, and I think then it changes the nature of the discussion because it's not so black and white then. It's not for or against. It's, you know, are you for this or for that rather than. And, yeah, Elizabeth.
You can raise money and send it as food to the refugees.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was just saying that we could, when some people have said they're bombing, but we could send food to the refugee, the African refugees.
Yeah, I was thinking, I had the same thought, and I thought that when things get a little bit more settled and clear. Because to me, it's not clear where things stand right now. It's so soon, but maybe at some point, like we did the week after September 11th, we had all the Donna baskets go toward the American Red Cross. Maybe in some time, it shouldn't be too soon, because then it becomes. I felt it's too soon in the heels of what happened. It's a little bit disrespectful of the tragedy that happened. We don't want to be, you know, it's a real tragedy, and people are still hurting from it. But at some point, when things become clear, maybe we can do the same thing. Have a sangha. Have Donna basket and do exactly what Elizabeth is saying. Have it go towards maybe Afghani refugee camps or some place like that where we can express an alternative response.
I know that we should be respectful about what happened, but is it now when everybody is meeting that situation with anger and hatred? Is it now when everybody's like building up war strategies and building up, you know, just endless, like a whole, just million, it feels like thousands and thousands of people are gearing up for like war. It just seems like, you know, we're letting them take the, you know, initiative, and I don't know, it just seems like it would be nice to be able to somehow engage in a situation where we give something.
It could be that this is the right time. I can speak for myself around this issue. Yeah.
Well, I see some positive things happening. We haven't done anything yet. And it does appear that there are some voices out there expressing this point of view at the top. And I understand that 4,000 donkeys are taking over 13,000-foot pass in Afghanistan. Now we have political business.
I think it's nice to wait a little bit, because the rhetoric has been one thing, but the actions so far have, you know, there haven't been any overt actions. That it's mostly the rhetoric and what might happen that we're worried about. And each passing day, I wonder, you know, if there actually isn't some real wisdom behind the patience that the government is exhibiting. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but...
Which is why I think it's very important to raise the voice saying, on the side of that measured reaction and on the side of the compassionate reaction that goes with it. That what I did when I got back from jogging, where I could have just sat down and write group letters to Congress people about this very point. Yes. I think you can hear that side too.
I agree. Hey, Bill.
And what Elizabeth said, the question I have is, when are the Afghani people suffering? I think the answer to that question is they're suffering now.
And they were suffering 2 months ago, too. So the... Yeah.
You know, the thing that I struggle with on this is being able to hold it all. And, you know, I hear the solutions of, you know, I've seen the emails on bombing with butter and the idea that we would somehow... you know, interact with the Afghani population, and I, you know, here I work for the government, so I certainly hear the other side in terms of there's a lot of patriotism and a lot of people waving flags and things, and the thing that I keep looking at is the fact that I don't think either of the solutions really are the solution that we should be looking at. I think we really need to look at what the deeper issues are. You know, it's not just about the Afghanis, it's about our, you know, how we relate in the world, how America comes forward in the world. And I think those issues of, like, really being able to look at how our actions, you know, actually feed into this system and feed into the terrorism without, you know, I mean, I personally lost someone in the tragedy, and so I had a very personal connection to it. But interestingly enough, her family, her closest family, are totally... for not retaliating in terms of, you know, war. But so how do we get down to the really deeper issues? And I think that's where our practice and our Sangha and Buddhism in general has the place. You know, I think that's our responsibility. I think it's fine to support the people that are affected by it and to, you know, to do all of these actions, but where we're really going to make a difference is in looking beyond, you know, what's needed immediately.
Mm-hmm. And so there's both the social level, the cultural level, the political level of our country, and economical level. There's also the very personal level in ourselves. And in a sense, I think the greatest contribution Buddhism has to offer is not any great wise analysis of the political situation, but rather is the careful study of the forces of greed, hate, and delusion within the individual, the attachment to self, and the way the attachments to self, self-clinging, is one of the important roots that gives birth to violence in the world. Every act of violence, can be said, or every act of war is perpetuated by individual people who make decisions. And those individual people are operating on some of the same forces that are operating in us. And so I think the real contribution Buddhism has to make, I feel, has to do with offering a very powerful practice that helps us get into the root of the very personal causes for these things. That's my take. Whether Buddhism as a religion is supposed to have a response, you know, beyond that, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of wise, you know, Buddhist political theory. Yeah.
I visited Pakistan about 10 years ago to see the early Buddhist movements in the Swat Valley. And the region isn't very female friendly. And I visited some of the towns where they were selling rocket launchers and mortar, and the children selling bullets, and they're all test driving these things. And I had to leave the town crying because the sound of gunfire was so upsetting. And I felt that sense of we and them being so different. And the poverty in the area and in Afghanistan, it doesn't make any sense to bomb people who don't have a clue what they're doing. They see us as being so rich and having so much. How do we end up with all the goods we have?
Right.
That Ajahn Amaro was giving a talk heard last weekend, and he was saying the best way to fight enemies is not to have enemies. And again, to look at the root cause of it, which is, seems to make sense.
Yes, Bimbo. Sorry.
Two points I wish to make. One is that reading about it, the event that Palo Alto City is sponsoring to plant a tree, and it's happening a week from Tuesday at noon at a park in Palo Alto. I can get more details to look at first, and I'm sure it's in the weekly. But it made me think, but I wonder if that's something that we would be interested in doing, and how to organize that. Or maybe that would be the first thing to do at the new spot that we're moving to. It's kind of being dedicated to the event. And the other thing I want to say, between the original Thich Nhat Hanh, Call Me By My True Name, came to attention because I'm listening to that tape in my car, and I was at the event at which the tape was made at Grace Cathedral. And I was wondering if there's a tape recorder here. We can listen to it while we get our food or whatever. We can just put some background. Is there a tape deck here?
No. I don't think so. This is a...
No.
So, one of the things I've been trying to do is kind of as the teacher for our community in this kind of role that I have is to try to gauge kind of the process, the group process of how we're responding to September 11th and how to deal with it. And my kind of approach, my idea is that it's a slow process over a long time, and there's different elements, different times to address and deal with. And so some people, as individuals, some people are ahead and some people are behind, and have other, you know, other ways of responding and reacting. Most important point I wanted to get across today was, and partly I was talking to myself, is the tremendous appreciation and need and desire for compassion and kindness, and that it's not always easy to have those, but there can be a dedication to trying to keep those doors open. And to try to find the ways where compassion becomes the wellsprings for how we go through our lives. So, in a minute, we'll stop for our potluck. Those of you who will stay, and if you didn't bring anything, please stay anyway. If you'd like to stay, and since it is the potluck day. That perhaps before you leave the room here, just before as we break here, if you can turn to one or two people who are near you, who you least know, and just introduce yourself and just say hello, so there's some connection, that'd be very nice. Yes, you. Yeah.
I was just going to say I noticed we're going to be empty on the garden, and I have compassion for those people, so either inside or out here.
Okay, so. Yeah, so why don't you say hello to someone, and then we can all go to our next event. Thank you.